Welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, and with me as always is...
Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Good evening, Hannah.
Good evening, Charlie.
So let me explain what this bottle of wine is we have going on.
Please do.
It's called 19 Crimes, and it only says red wine. It doesn't say what kind of red wine, just red wine. And so one of the crimes could be this wine. But it's about, remember, in the 18th century, in England, if you were convicted of one of the 19 crimes... They didn't kill you. They transported you to Australia. So this is an Australian wine called 19 Crimes.
Well, there's an actual story.
And I thought about it because I think one of the 19 crimes was in 18th century England is if you had anything to do with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you were convicted of one of the 19 crimes.
Okay.
Cinematic crimes.
Good to know.
So I've already tasted it. It's I find it underwhelming.
But... It's underwhelming, but it's not bad. You know, I would say, you know, I know it's fine. I know you hate that, but it's fine.
Let me guess. It's nice and fine?
It's nice. It's fine.
So this week, we both saw one of the blockbusters, but then we had to split up. There were screenings at the same time, same date, different theaters. We should have probably switched. I went to the big blockbuster that's, you know, built for kids, and she went to the romantic, I don't know if you want to call it a rom-com. No,
romantic drama.
Yeah, because they handed out Kleenex. You got swag in yours, and it's a thing of Kleenex, so I guess you would call it a romantic drama. Maybe I should have gone to the romantic drama, and you should have gone to the Ninja Turtles.
I really would have liked to see you go to me before you, but what's really funny is that you actually had the nerve to say... I wonder which one of us should go to which. And I was like, there's not even a question. I am not going to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 over the obvious chick flick, Me Before You.
No, but I think it would have been interesting for the podcast because, you know what, step outside of your comfort boundaries.
It would, but that was one where I was like, no.
Okay.
Sometimes you just got to draw the line.
Well, a lot of people in my audience were like, no, after that film. But we're not going to start with that. We're going to start with pop star... Never Stop, Never Stopping. It's a mockumentary. Think This Is Spinal Tap, Best in Show, even Borat. Those are all mockumentaries. Mm-hmm. And it's mocking a kind of a recent trend of popumentaries. Justin Bieber released a film. It was called Never Say Never, so very similar titles. One Direction released one. Katy Perry released one. So they're making fun of those. And it's funny. It's made by the Lonely Island from Saturday Night Live. Stars Andy Samberg. Hannah, I laughed.
I did too, and I was pleasantly surprised by this one. It reminded me a lot of anyone who used to watch all the VH1 documentaries Behind the Music. Mm. This was structured in very much the same way as one of those. So if you like a Behind the Music meets Spinal Tap, that's kind of what you're getting from here. And it was just pure entertainment. I think everybody kind of left there with a smile on their face. Nobody hated it. There was nobody who left that theater that I can recall who actually had anything really negative to say about it.
It's 80% Rotten Tomatoes, which is quite high.
Yeah.
Especially for a comedy starring Andy Samberg, when you think about it. So The Lonely Island, that's three gentlemen. Andy Samberg is kind of the pretty face of the crew, but the other two are Yorma Taconi and Akiva Schaffer. Now, they were all three of them, hired on Saturday Night Live the same year, 2005. But Samberg was hired into the cast. The other two is writers. And they know each other from junior high. They went to junior high school together in Berkeley. So they've had all this time to establish their roles and rapport. And I think it works. They know how to riff off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it was... But the premise of this is that one leaps to stardom a lot further than the other two. And I think that's actually true to life. Nobody knows the names off the top of their head.
I wonder if they were exploring some sort of real world anxieties.
I would not be surprised. It was a little Entourage-ish in its feel sometimes where you had, you know, from Entourage where you just had Vince who everybody kind of was second banana to all the time. And that's sort of what's happening in this. And then it moves into those behind the music type of, you know, can we get these guys back together? So the idea is that they were all part of this sort of pop boy band.
They were the Style Boys with a Z, of course.
Yeah. So
Style Boys.
Yeah. So they were all part of the Style Boys, but then Andy Samberg's character goes solo and strikes it big. And
his name, by the way, is Connor, but his stage name is Connor For Real. Numeral 4 in there, so
yes.
Connor For Real.
And he's very into his social media, his tweets and things, so he's got a little bit of currency going with that. And it just takes that, it just take that genre where you deconstruct what happened to the Style Boys and how influential they were to all these other musicians. And so there's a series of really clever cameos throughout this movie.
I'm talking A-list celebrities. Yeah. I mean, we're the amount of people that show Usher,
Mariah
Nas,
Carey.
Carrie Underwood. There's a Beatle. A former Beatle shows up and he says, doink da doink.
it's very clever. And I was just shocked by how it maintained the funny. You know, sometimes these Saturday Night Live skits go on for too long and just go off the rails. This just took an interesting little turn, and there are a few really gross things in there. They're not gross, but there's that one scene up against the car with the guy who strips his...
Yeah. I'll tell you later who that is, by the way.
I don't know if I want to know.
That's a famous person.
Uncredited genitalia, perhaps. But it really was just an absolutely fun movie. So considering all these other things that we will have seen, if you're in the mood to cry, then the one we'll get to a little bit later is the one to go to. But if you're in the mood to just laugh, I would say this is the best laugh out loud movie I've seen in quite a while.
No, this is the best laugh out loud movie we've seen since Keanu.
Yeah,
and Keanu
absolutely.
Was funnier.
But I think this one will resonate with more people, especially anybody who likes those mockumentaries. It is very well done.
Well, what separated Andy Samberg among his cast back then, I mean, that was a big heavy hitters on Saturday Night Live back then. Jimmy Fallon, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, they were all on at the same time. But Andy Samberg separated himself because he started doing digital shorts, these fake rap songs, frap songs, if you will. And, I mean, the one that's most famous today is Blank in a Box.
Right.
Everyone knows Blank in a Box. So almost half of Popstar is these fake rap songs. So Connor Farrell is this pop rapper, and he's releasing his second album, and everyone knows it's going to tank except him. He thinks it's going to be the best album of all time. And some of the songs are actually really ingenious. There's F Me Like We F Bin Laden. It's probably the strongest song. Mm-hmm. There's Humble. He's telling us how humble he is standing in front of his Lamborghini and how expensive everything is, but he's really humble.
Yeah.
And Equal Rights.
Equal Rights for Gay Marriage. That was hysterical.
he's making fun of Macklemore. You know, they're talking about he wants gay marriage for everyone. And, you know, what's funny is gay marriage is legal, and he doesn't know that. And he spends the whole time going, gay marriage, equal rights, but I'm straight.
Yeah.
Sports, I'm straight, but you can be gay. It's okay.
Yeah, it was a lot of very clever writing, and they did. There's a whole soundtrack to this movie, and there's some very funny scenes with Justin Timberlake not playing himself. And so that was a lot of fun within the context of this movie, too.
Well, I think my favorite part were the songs and the stage performances, a lot of stage performances. I didn't like the actual story filler, the plot. It's so predictable. Rise, fall, get back together, rise. That was filler after a while.
But that's what makes it exactly like a standard behind the music. They all were that formula. So the formula is exactly the same. And they do a spot-on hysterical spoof of the TMZ
Will Arnett
guys.
Yeah, he's drinking his drinks get bigger and bigger, these like big gulps.
The big gulps that Harvey Levin always has during
leaning over the wall, and they're all laughing at their own jokes. I've seen bits and pieces of TMZ every now and then, so I guess it kind of looks like that.
It was spot on. Every single person matched the people that are
So they're actually these real people.
No.
I mean, I know it's not the same people, but they're playing real people.
The real people. There's the guy with the dreads who, he actually came from legitimate news because I met him. I actually interviewed at TMZ. When that show was just starting, and sat in on one of those bullpen meetings that are held at like 6 a.m. and that's why they've all got the big gulps and the caffeine going. And every single character that was mocked in that scene, there is the absolute equivalent of that person who you would see. So anybody who watches TMZ will absolutely recognize every single one of those characters and just realize how hysterically spot on those scenes are.
Well, Saturday Night Live movies don't always work, but this one, it works. I was happy. I'm glad. I felt good walking out of it.
Excellent.
Unlike the next movie I'm going to talk about, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. Please put them back in the shadows. I was one of the very small select handful of movie reviewers who liked 2014's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles franchise reboot. I liked it. I thought the turtles looked much more realistic now with the technology. The 3D was effective. The 3D worked. It was in your face. The story was stupid, but the jokes were kind of funny. So everything I liked about that now is gone. It's hard to tell realism in 3D now because the cuts are so fast, especially in the action scenes. You can't tell what's going on. The jokes are lame. They're mocking themselves. The story is atrocious. The acting is atrocious. Tyler Perry is in this movie, and he is probably... He acts worse than he does in Madea movies. Laura Linney, three-time Oscar nominee Laura Linney, is in this movie, and you can see it on her face. Oh my God, I'm in a Ninja Turtles movie. You're not sad you missed this? You're not going to run out tonight and see it?
No, and the thing is, I never saw the first one, and that's why I could not fathom going to see the second one. I really feel like I would have needed the full backstory to truly appreciate it.
Did you see the ones that came out in the early 90s?
No, because that was not my... era.
I did. I inhaled those.
Exactly. And I was, they came out way after I was well past that that particular type of television. And so I did not see any of them. But I mean, I knew like the names of the turtles. I knew Michelangelo and things like that.
There's three more.
I know. And I don't know any of the other three. Actually, I would if you, I think I kind of do. They've all got like the Italian names and stuff, don't they?
Ish,
Italian-ish names. But I don't feel bad that I missed this one, and I'd be hard-pressed to find any reason to go out and catch this one at any point, other than if you really thought it was really, really, really bad and thought it could make, like, my 10 worst movies of the year.
Good.
But
it's in my top five right now. But.
Yeah. And the only other reason is just that I'm always curious as to whether something's really as bad as you think it is. Because sometimes that's just not the case.
Yeah. You're doubting my opinions about movies. I don't understand. Well, this is a loose remake of 1991's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. And so Shredder, he's the bad guy. They captured him at the end of the last movie. So at the beginning of this movie, he escapes. Naturally, in this really interesting chase scene, prison convoy. But during the escape, he accidentally gets teleported to another dimension. And in that dimension, he meets Krang. Now, I remember Krang from the cartoons. He was never in a movie before, I don't think. But in the cartoons, he's his brain. He's a brain attached to a robot, kind of lives in the robot's midsection. This thing is so disgusting and revolting. It looks like a chewed up piece of bubble gum with a face on it. It's I mean, the kids are going
to
love it.
I was about to say, so this sounds like something, though, that even though you don't like it,
it's filthy.
Some of those kids out there might really have a good old time with it.
So Krang sends Shredder back, say, put these pieces of this alien device together. It'll open up a portal. I can come through. We'll rule the world, right? And, man, it's just, you think Tyler Perry would be the worst actor, and he kind of is, but he's the worst actor of the worst actors. So Megan Fox is... investigative reporter April O'Neil, and this is produced by Michael Bay. And if you didn't see his name in the credits, you would know that, because you've seen Transformers. You remember Transformers? She was in the first two,
right.
And the camera had a fixation with Megan Fox. It was always looking up at her or bending over a motorcycle. There were a lot of interesting Megan Fox
cleavage shots.
Well, the first this movie is for 9-year-olds.
Yeah.
The first time we see April O'Neil, she's in this disguise, and then she has to quickly change out of this disguise. So she changes into Catholic schoolgirl porn star. She ties the shirt up, exposing her midriff, the really short skirt, and she makes herself into this statutory rape jailbait. And I'm like, this is, you know, they don't know what they're looking at. These little 9-year-old kids who are there for the turtles, they have no idea. Like, I guess I'm supposed to like this, but I don't know why. And
but the 12-year-old boys will like it.
Well, and you know, so will the 35-year-olds, I guess. Ah. But it felt weird being in this movie, this fetishizing of Megan Fox once again in a Michael Bay production.
Yeah,
There's not a lot of good stuff going on in this movie, Hannah. There's a theme. The overall theme was restlessness. The turtles still live in the shadows. They can't come out because, you know, humans will freak. Oh my God, turtles! But they want to go out and they want to have fun, and they can't. And the ooze that shows up again could turn them human. So they're wrestling. Am I a turtle? Am I a human? It reminded me of, like, the Muppets, almost, that Muppet or Man song that Jason Segel was singing.
Yeah.
This is even so. If you have kids and they're scrambling, they say, "Please, please, please, take Ninja Turtles." Don't take them to the Jungle Book again.
You're still pushing the plug in the Jungle Book
because it's probably the best family film of the year.
Well, and you know, Zootopia is out on DVD next week.
Yeah, I know.
Week,
so and I would I'm just not say, plugging that. That one. I am not plugging Zootopia.
I would plug Zootopia if they haven't seen that one yet. Then that's fine for that age group. But we'll have to see if anyone I know goes to see the turtle movie. So
it's
going to
win the weekend, though. I think it's going to win the weekend.
And I'm not going to bet against it because the one that I saw was Me Before You.
Mm.
And it is a romantic drama chick flick. There are not many guys that are going to go out of their way to go see this unless they are being dragged.
They're
going to
be taken. Yeah.
It was a huge book club book. And so a lot of women have read this book and they were looking forward to going to see the movie. And I, in advance of going to see the movie, I plowed through
possible mistake,
the novel.
By the way, because that can make the movie worse for you.
But it, in some cases, in some ways it did, but and the book is so much better. So I plowed through it over Memorial Day weekend. I should say I bawled through it because I did.
Really?
Oh my goodness, I was a mess. I absolutely cried through probably the last 25% of that book.
That leads me to believe I know what happens to the guy.
As did many others. But it's not a big secret and it's not a huge surprise. But it's about this 26-year-old caregiver. This woman who's just basically lived a very sheltered, kind of quiet life. And she's played by Emilia Clarke, who a lot of people know from Game of Thrones, which I'm not a regular viewer of, but people really do know who she is. And a lot of the women who were at the screening were eager to see her. And she's very cute.
I don't watch Game of Thrones either, but I remember she was the best part of last year's Terminator Genisys.
Oh, well, she's very endearing. There's a very likable quality about her. And so she plays this young woman named Louisa Clarke, who goes to work for this millionaire quadriplegic named Will Traynor, and he's played by Sam Claflin, who was Finnick in the Hunger Games movies.
Kind of a minor role in that movie.
And yeah, but in this one, he is the most watchable element of this movie. He is very cute.
You know what? This sounds like that French movie that everyone saw a couple years ago, The Inn.
The Inn. What was that? It's a similar.
It sounds exactly like that.
Yeah. What was that? I love that movie. It was.
That's like
the
Impossible.
One guy,
I was the one guy on earth who did not like that movie.
Oh, I love.
And
that
they're making
movie.
An American version of it.
I know, but it was a great movie.
It's like The Inn. Gosh, The Intouchables.
Intouchables. The Intouchables. Yes, it's a French movie. Stupid that's movie. Excellent. It's excellent. It's one of the few indies that I ever like absolutely would recommend 100 times over. But anyway, we digress. With Me Before You, it's really about, it's a movie that's about right to die, choices. You have this quadriplegic who, he's supposed to be in his like early 30s, maybe mid 30s. He was this millionaire, playboy, adventurer, top businessman, loving life, and he ends up getting hit by a motorcycle in an accident and becoming a quadriplegic and not being able to really move anything. He has a little tiny bit of movement, I think, in one of his hands, but he's basically paralyzed from the neck down. And his mother wants to hire somebody for 6 months to try and bring joy into his life because he's been pretty miserable for 2 years.
Now, I'm looking at the movie poster right now, and I love how you say she wants to bring joy to his life, and she hired the hottest chick ever.
Well, you know, she needed somebody to sort of spark a little something in him. But it really, it's about how he transforms her life, too, that he wants her to live life fuller. And then she wants him to enjoy life more than he currently is. And she finds out, and this is not a spoiler, because certainly anybody who's read the book knows how this plays out.
This is a possible spoiler if you haven't read the book then.
If you haven't, no, because it really, anybody who knows what this movie is about knows that essentially this guy he's given his parents, he's told everybody that in 6 months' time he plans to end his life by going to this clinic in Switzerland and basically doing assisted suicide. And so the story then becomes trying to convince him that life is worth living, even in these conditions that he just feels are beyond the way that he wants to live. And his old life was who he was. And so even though these two fall in love, and she thinks that that should be enough for him, he does not want to burden her with that life. And he's also still not necessarily satisfied with what it means to him to not be able to ever, to know that you're never going to go back to the way you were. And he's in a lot of pain. And there are a lot of things in the book that the movie does not touch upon. And so a lot of
people... That's why you don't read the book before you see the movie.
but you had to fill in some gaps. So if you're watching the movie, you're kind of filling in some of the gaps in the story with what you know and what you read, because there are some things that wouldn't necessarily make all that much sense, but it's the same.
And that's the fault of the movie. You should be knocking the movie for that.
Well, but you can't really knock it, because the woman who wrote the book, JoJo, she writes a screenplay too. And so the fact that she actually, JoJo Moyes, so the fact that she was able to write both, she was making those decisions as to what would bring it into an under 2 hour movie. And it is a true chick flick. I mean, I did not cry nearly as much watching the movie as I did reading the book. The book just had a much more powerful message, because it showed so many additional layers of perspective that you just can't fit into this movie. So for anyone who did not read the book, yeah, they might actually just look at it as a pretty stripped down drama, almost like your favorite movie, The Choice. So it's much better than The Choice, but it's got some of the same themes towards the end that movie did.
It does seem like there's a little Nicholas Sparks thing going on in here.
Yeah, there is that. So anybody who likes The Notebook or the Nicholas Sparks movies, we'll probably want to go see this one. It's been very divisive. I've seen a lot of people split as to whether or not the message is all wrong, that there are some people who've written about, relatives and quadriplegic and paraplegics who feel that it's sending this message that life is, that for some people it's worth giving up, or they want to give up. And so it's divided people, and other people are saying, look, you have to respect the choice of the individual. It's their life, and you want them to make their own choices and support them as best you can. And if that means a choice that you don't agree with, sometimes you just have to be okay with that. And so it's a very moving story, and what makes it work is really the chemistry between these two. They are just very sweet. She is not quite what I pictured. I think if you've read the book, you picture somebody not quite so attractive.
She's smoking hot.
And she is, and she's dressing up in the movie poster for a specific scene, but she is instantly still pretty attractive, although she dresses very funky. And he's smoking hot from the get-go. And so no matter what, you just... You feel something for this pair, and you get an emotional attachment. But again, the book is much stronger and deeper, and provides a lot more context. And they've glossed over several relationships that exist in the book that don't exist in the movie. And so purists of the book might have a hard time with that. But there's also, I know you'll be thrilled to know this, there is a sequel to this book that's already done. So this is Me Before You. The sequel is Me After You. And when I read the book, they provided the first chapter for that next one. And so if this movie does well enough, rest assured there will be a Me After You in the theaters probably in the next couple of years.
Makes it sound like if there's ever a third book, it'll just be called You.
Or me.
But the way you explain it, I guess I should have read the novel Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, because there's probably relationships I missed and that's subtleties.
Right.
And you explain it better than the movie poster here does. There's a hashtag slogan on here that says, live boldly. Yes. Hashtag live boldly. Like, wow, way to...
That sums up what the theme of the movie from Will Traynor's perspective, from the guy in the wheelchair, and he lived a very bold life, and he wants that for this Louisa Clark character. He wants her to live boldly and to break free from this small town life that she's been living, and to fulfill her potential. And so, yes, the movie definitely is trying to encourage everyone to hashtag live boldly.
Sounds like you liked it better than Popstar.
No. No, I didn't. I mean, it's so different. It's not like you can tell somebody to go see one over the other. This is going to, Me Before You, it's a romantic drama chick flick for the people who read the book and want to see the movie regardless, and for anyone who then otherwise just is into seeing just a good romantic drama chick flick. Popstar was more fun. I absolutely had a lot more enjoyable moments. I came out of Popstar laughing. I came out of Me Before You just kind of dabbing my eyes a little bit.
Well, Popstar, Ninja Turtles, and Me Before You are the films that are saturating your local multiplex. They're everywhere and they're every town. We also saw two documentaries this week that are probably not in your neck of the woods. They're in major cities, and they'll end up, I think one of them's already on video on demand. The first one we're going to talk about is, it's called Presenting Princess Shaw. Princess Shaw is a nom de plume of one Samantha Montgomery. She is an assistant nurse at elder care in New Orleans, so very poor, but she does YouTube on the side, and she kind of treats it as her own diary. She says, this is how my day was. She sings. She composes her own lyrics. She just can't set them to music, but she just sings her songs. She has a pretty good voice, and she also gets very personal on it. She talks about former sexual abuse, and, you know, she just details her current life and life problems. You know, she moves into this apartment. The electricity gets shut off. The tires get stolen off her car. Princess Shaw is having a rough time. Break. On the other side of the world in Israel, one Ophir Kutiman is watching. He's like one of the 83 views on her YouTube channel. Takes her singing, sets it to some other beats he has found, like a kid playing a piano, a bassoon, and he makes tunes out of it. He publishes it. Princess Shaw goes viral. Supposed to be a feel-good documentary. Man, I was bored stiff, Hannah.
I've got to agree with you. I'm usually very forgiving on music-related documentaries. They generally appeal to me. But I feel like if you don't know the backstory going into watching this documentary, you will not have a clue what's going on. It's very poorly constructed. And I tuned out. I was multitasking while watching it. I watched the first half hour and then multitasked through the rest. It's not all that long, but it feels long.
Oh, man.
And it just never quite, it just never gelled. And the whole middle, I couldn't care less what was going on.
It takes a long time for Kutiman to hit the publish button, let me tell you.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's his whole shtick, is just creating art out of
other people's
YouTube videos and kind of mixing. You know, he's like a mix master for the YouTubers, and he's got his own little following. But it just, first of all, I don't think her talent is really all that much better than a lot of other folks that you'd find on YouTube. I think if you go through and you know, cycle through a bunch of those other people doing those confessional type YouTube things, it's a diary. And, you know, sure, it struck a chord with this guy in Israel, but it just didn't have a story that ever got me, and I never understood quite where they were going with it and how they happened upon some of the footage. It just seems strange to me, some of the footage that they had.
Where seems you knew like there a was, setup. Yeah.
It seemed too set up, because you're like, how there, would there possibly be a camera available even for making a documentary for these very minor moments that nobody would ever have put a camera on? And she's got some talent, and she's got big dreams, and so, you know, people would root for her. But she's totally a fish out of water. They bring her over to Tel Aviv at one point to actually perform in a concert in Tel Aviv. And that's sort of the climax of the movie, is her getting to really just experience the life of a star, even however briefly. And it's, you know, great. Great for her. But yeah, the movie as a whole just completely fell flat, and is not a music documentary that would even remotely break into my top favorites for documentaries.
It had me feeling some sympathy for her. You know, she's pretty brave. She gets up and performs in front of these empty community center rooms, like not necessarily karaoke night, but local talent show night. And there's nobody, or people just get up and leave, and she just keeps on singing. She tries out for The Voice, and man, that really throws her for a loop. I mean, you're not going to get on The Voice, woman, but man, she takes that pretty personally. But we're in the minority here. People love this movie. It was at Sundance. It's on the festival circuit. A lot of people are rooting for Princess Shaw, and they felt this documentary, and it makes me wonder, what were you feeling other than boredom?
I know, and I saw some positive reviews too, and I expected more. I was looking forward to seeing this one, and so to me that just added to the disappointment that it seemed like the type of movie that I would absolutely go for, and yet I was bored.
Well,
bored.
Speaking of bored, tell us about the second documentary we saw this week.
So the second one was another one that I would never in a million years have seen if you had not told me to go and actually watch the screening link, which I did. but it's called Hockney, and it is about an artist named, I believe, David Hockney, who some people may know of. I had never heard of the guy before. It's a very traditional documentary. They were able to, it's a British film, they were able to take advantage of these interviews from years ago intermixed with more current footage, and they actually talked to the guy. He's like 78 now and still working out of his studio every day. And it's about his journey to, I guess, stardom even later in life, and his paintings. He does paintings and photography, and there are a few interesting aspects to this movie when he's describing a painting, and I'd actually like look at it and go, okay, I would not have ever cared about this painting originally, but to hear somebody kind of explain what they see in it gave it some context that was okay. But the only people that are really going to maybe like or care about this movie are people who already knew who Hockney is. And anyone else, unless they're really in the arts community and is just curious to see what this guy's life journey was, and his journey basically from, I think, England to California and living the American dream, sort of, and just becoming this visual artist. Anyone other than the artsy folks, I think they're not going to really like it. And I did. It's another one where it was very long. It felt long. And I got quite bored, even though I did. I think I made it through the whole thing. But I was a little bored by it. It's still better than Princess Shaw, but it was not.
I'm gonna give Princess Shaw the edge on
really?
This one. I didn't know either who David Hockney was. And now that I know, I still don't care. He's 78 now, and it shows us his kind of transformation from conservative England to out there liberal Los Angeles, and he becomes flamboyant. It shows you why he's known for being very blonde, and it shows you why he made that choice to become very blonde. It's a Clairol commercial.
Yeah, that was an interesting little tidbit.
And you see some of his early work, this abstract expressionism. There's a lot of stuff about swimming pools, and then it ends up, you know, he now does art on like iPads. And yeah, I did not get a lot out of this documentary. I was bored during Princess Shaw. I wanted to die during this one.
See, I was the reverse. I was a little more intrigued by this one. Every once in a while, like when they'd show his photographs, and he would explain that the difference, the perspective, that the camera only sees this photo for a second, but you can be looking at it for minutes at a time. And so how you look at it different than what the camera caught in just that second. And so there were little things like that that were just interesting, but I did not, I just found it better constructed than Princess Shaw. I do think there was a problem with the fact that I don't think they labeled people very well in this movie. I think I remember that the IDs on people that popped up to talk about Hockney, they'd give their names, but they didn't really tell their relationship to him. Like whether they were an art dealer or a former lover or, a relative. So that, I think, was missing and kind of assumed a little too much on the part of anyone that just might go into this movie blind.
I see the confusion. I remember at the beginning, it was all his friends and stuff talking about him, so I thought he was dead.
Yeah, I did too. When I discovered that at 78 he was alive, the only clue I had was when you suddenly realized that they were then doing these, there was an interview with this guy who was much older, and you realize it was the same guy. And he looked a lot like sort of Andy Warhol.
He does look like Andy Warhol. He looked
a lot like Andy Warhol in his younger days with the big glasses and the shocking blonde hair. But I never knew his name. I always knew Andy Warhol's name, but I never knew David Hockney's name. So anybody out there who knows David Hockney's name, they probably might get a lot more out of this movie. I can't see anybody just going out of their way to find it.
No one's going to go see this movie.
I don't think anyone's going to see it. But Hockney fans, like, if, I don't know, does he have a following? If he's got groupies, any Hockney groupies out there, they'll go and see it.
You know what? If you're listening to this podcast and you know who David Hockney is, track us down and let us know.
Do.
And I guarantee you, I'm not going to hear from any of you.
There's
no way I'm going to hear from, oh, I know, I am David Hockney, and I'm listening to your podcast.
You can tweet us at Radio St. Pete.
So speaking of that, I think this is our last Cinema Clash for a couple weeks. We are going on, I guess, an early summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, two, 3 weeks?
Two weeks or 3 weeks. It depends on whether we're able to scrape something together the week of the AFI Documentary Festival that's in town, the 22nd through the 25th.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to go see about 4 or 5 documentaries a day and for about 5 days, 4 or 5 days. And I think we want to make a podcast out of that one.
Yeah, I'll see 1 or 2, maybe 3.
That sounds like something
to do. No, I'll see a good number of them, but I will try. But in the meantime, there are a bunch of different movies that will be coming out in the interim, and we will try and catch up on some of those when we return. And we'll still offer something up for the folks who tune in at the regular time each week. And I think next week, perhaps, we're going to let everyone in on a replay of our top and best and worst. 10. Was it our best and worst of 2015?
Yeah, I think those were two separate ones. We did our top 10 of 2015. And I think the next week it was the top 5 worst, because you didn't want to be too mean, so you said top 5.
That's right. So we'll figure that out, and we'll choose our favorites, and we'll make sure that that in case you missed it, especially with the summer months ahead, there are a lot of movies that were the best movies of 2015, and they're all out on video now or streaming. Mm-hmm. So it's a good time to catch up on really the good movies that you might have missed, because there are a lot of really bad ones coming down the pike.
Well, they can hear about all my foreign films that no one's ever heard of.
That's right.
And the little indies that you love, like something called Star Wars, is it's made like number 2 on your list.
That's right. Yes, you will hear the real deal.
So to wrap this up, surprisingly, Pop Star, Never Stopping is seriously funny, and I think it's the second best comedy of the year so far, right behind Keanu.
I even edge it out. I put it above Keanu, so I enjoyed it too, and I think anybody, again, if you saw VH1 Behind the Music, this is a great spoof that you'll just totally enjoy.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows is, I think, one of the 19 crimes in the bottle of wine I am drinking right now. Well, Do not go see that movie.
Well, thank you for the wine, Charlie. But and Me Before You, you'll need the whole bottle of wine after you come out of this one. It's not as raw and emotional as a lot of people were expecting, but you will still bring a couple of tissues protectively, because you may need them.
The documentary presenting Princess Shaw should be good. The subject matter is there. A lot of people think it is good. No, it's not.
It's not. It's really, really boring and just falls flat.
And what was the other one?
Hockney. And the other one's Hockney, about the artist I'd never heard of before, David Hockney. So really, again, we're waiting for all those viewers, listeners out there, to actually let us know if they're interested in a David Hockney documentary.
And we flip-flopped on the ranking. I put Hockney on the bottom and Princess Shaw a little bit above.
Yeah, and I'm the opposite, surprisingly.
All right. Well, for the next couple weeks, thank you for listening. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you very much.